So welcome to Adelaide Chronicle, Sue, and thank you for agreeing to talk to us. And do you want to just introduce yourself, give a bit of a spiel on who you are?
Well, thanks, Sue. So my name's Sue, and my roots are in South Africa, and I've lived in Australia for the last 12 or so years. I guess my story is a long and varied and layered one. So I'm not really quite sure where to start. But maybe I'll start with here and now and unravel some of the touchstones of my past as we go. So I think having grown up as a descendant of white settler migrants in South Africa, and all the unconscious bias and assumed privileges that came with that, and then in the last 12 or so years having transposed my life to Australia and to living here from South Africa to Australia, once again as a privileged white migrant, as a settler, I guess I'm acutely aware of the effects of across both countries of colonization, of racism, of loss of place and identity for people who were dispossessed and relocated and moved on. And the ways in which the kind of stratification of class in both countries, but also the way it fairly uniquely intersects with race, which, as we know, is a kind of political construct. So essentially, class intersecting with race, gender, age, cultures, and how it's perpetuated and protected, both here and in South Africa. And I think having lived in both countries, it's almost in a way enabled me to compare the dark histories of both places, both these colonies, really.
Both colonised by the British.
British, and in South Africa's case, by the Dutch.
By the Dutch, right.
And the British, different periods of time. You know, one can look at the differences in the nature of how colonising happened. I mean, initially, the Cape of South Africa was a kind of refreshment station for the Dutch en route to the East Indies to get spices, and it was kind of only a little bit later that it became a kind of settler colony. Whereas I think Australia has a much deeper, or initially was a kind of settler colonial.
It was the original intention.
To settle people here, to bring convicts here. It was slightly less, or not completely less, kind of extractive in terms of just getting resources. It was about actually settling people here, partly to solve the unemployment crisis in Britain, but to get rid of all the naughty convicts. So the intention was a lot more around settling in Australia, whereas initially in South Africa it was more kind of extractive and resources for ships going to the east. Mm.
Can I just ask you for your interpretation of the word settler and how it relates to unsettled and settled? Yes. It's an interesting word, isn't it? A settler. We immediately know what we're talking about, but there was nothing settled about it.
No, it's profoundly unsettling for the people who are displaced by the settlement. On some level, it's unsettling for the people who are being settled here, you know. There's a... coming from another culture, another country, another way of life, either through forced settlement, in the case of Australia, to, I don't know if you look at books like The Secret Country, you know, what that meant. While those people were being the colonisers and the settlers, they were also grappling with their own stories and their own bewilderment and their confusion and their place and their identity.
And the only thing they could do was try and adapt this country to their old one, to make it the same, which would never work.
So there was that, people cling to what they know, so they perpetuated what they knew from the old country, wherever that might have been. And it doesn't make their actions any less culpable in terms of what they did to First Nations people or the land they stole, but they were also coping with their own stuff, I guess. Yeah, no, I guess on a personal level for me, just my own story of leaving South Africa and coming to Australia is a huge transition, and that sense of always being an outsider, you never quite Australian, whatever that might mean. You know, your sense of place is tied to somewhere else in so many ways. So it's a constant state of adjusting and adjustment.
Do you feel you belong here now?
It's a tricky question. I don't know that I belong anywhere. You know, there's that living in kind of two worlds of... I guess because I don't operate on the basis of a kind of national identity.
Mm.
Or nationalist identity. For me, it's in South Africa. There was, you know, you grow up and you're South African, and you're kind of contesting the space because you grow up as a white South African, and you don't feel comfortable in that space. You don't belong. Your identity doesn't belong as I'm a white South African. So there's that constant thing of not attaching to your clan in the way you're expected to, not having that sense of belonging to that group. So, you know, just what's coming to mind is being in an all-girls, at that stage, white boarding school, because schools were segregated. And in 1976, so-called Soweto riots, which were students challenging, having to learn in Afrikaans and challenging the education system and the allocation of resources. That was in my second to last year at school. And when that started happening, I was like, yeah, damn right. Good for you, students. Go for it. Whereas all my peers at school were terrified. These black students rising up and rioting. So there was that constant thing of like, I don't speak the uniform language here with my white peers. And that feeling of you're an outsider. You don't quite belong in that space. And I guess that kind of then there was a sort of logical transition into taking up issues of inequality and racism and all of that in my, when I left school. So, and there you find a home with like-minded activists or people who see the world similarly. And so, yeah, there's a belonging in aspects of your life.
Was there a schism between people? Was there activists and non-activists? Or you said those girls were terrified.
They were terrified because they were sort of enculturated into being nice white girls at the nice white church boarding school. They'd never really encountered black people in their lives other than the people who worked in their homes.
As servants.
As slaves, as domestic workers, cleaning or doing the garden or doing the cooking. So that was the nature of their relationship with black people, black South Africans. And so there was, because they were the unknown, people were fearful.
That's a tough thing, feeling dislocated, as particularly as an adolescent.
Mm. Yeah.
But with the other activists, that was a sense of belonging.
I think there was a sense of belonging and of a shared perspective and a cause, So student activism, there was that sense of belonging and you were part of something and you were part of a movement and there was the belonging in that.
And was the activism divided into black and white or was it mutual?
No, I think that was one of the kind of really rich valuable things about the struggle in the 1980s was it really was very genuinely about a non-racial, non-sexist society. You know, that was the kind of slogan. And so a lot of the struggles were collective across everybody. There were obviously sort of more black consciousness movement people who kind of chose to be more separate in their struggle, but sort of across the board, I think there was, if you adhere to the principles and the cause, you're in. You're part of that struggle. So it was relatively inclusive, obviously with pockets of people who took maybe a more hardline position in terms of the sort of Black Consciousness Movement or the Pan-African Congress were more specific about who was in that grouping and not, which is perfectly understandable.
And the division between what was termed black and coloured, was that also large?
Look, I think there were joint shared struggles. Some of it was, I guess, sort of apartheid geography of South Africa. So people would, in terms of mobilising and organising, a lot of it was at quite a local level. So I don't think there was necessarily a sense of we're black African and you're so-called coloured and so we can't join forces. It was more that people struggled in their local geographic areas because of the apartheid segregation of that. There were clearly some movements that were far more culturally defined or sensitive about their own cause. I think in South Africa as well, there was, if you were black African, some of the tensions were if you were a so-called coloured person, and I don't like the term, but that was the apartheid language and how people were defined, you weren't white enough and you weren't black enough. So it was really quite a hard place for people to find themselves in. They were classified in their part of the way.
Was there a consensual intermarriage?
Oh, absolutely, but it was illegal.
It was illegal?
Yeah. So, you know, if you were found to be in a relationship with someone who wasn't of your race, whatever that might mean, of your skin colour, essentially, it was illegal. You could be in a jail. You would be jailed for that. And so you also find people who had children where the parents of those children couldn't necessarily live in the same house because one was so-called white and one was so-called black. And so the kid would, depending on their colour, would live with one or either of the parents, to make it less.
That's absurd.
Yeah. So, you know, love is made illegal, essentially. Mm. And that went on for a long time, you know. So it was in every sphere of people's lives, you know, absolutely private, personal, through to where you could and couldn't live, where you had to get a permit to go or not go, who you could and couldn't have a drink with, or who you couldn't sit in the same bus with, who you could go to school with. It was just.
But how were you taught these rules?
I think you're born into them.
You're born into
them. You socialised into them, and it was taken as a given, you know. It was, that was how the world was until, for me anyway. I mean, I was always kind of, couldn't quite work out how it was that I grew up as a farm kid, and my father was a conservative farm manager. And his treatment of farm workers was appalling. And he was my father, but he was doing these terrible things to farm workers. I couldn't, you know, the dissonance was just too much for a kid to kind of comprehend. So I guess that sets the seed of questioning and going, something's not right here. And then Soweto 76 happened, and you start going, okay, what's this all about? And exploring what's happening. And then sort of getting to university, and this whole world opened up of other ways of seeing the world and of engaging. And yes, my academic studies at university were not particularly dedicated. I was busy doing other stuff.
But it is fascinating, and you know, you talked about the difference between places like South Africa and Australia, and as a person growing up in Australia, I don't think I even saw a black person until I was, I don't know how old, maybe 15 or something, I don't know. You know, that again is absurd, but they just weren't around. They weren't in places that I was.
Yeah.
Whereas where you lived, they were everywhere. They were part of your, you knew that they were there always.
Yeah, and I think some of that is to do with demographics and population size. I mean, in South Africa, the population there is double Australia's, but the black population is the majority.
Mm.
And whites were the minorities. There was a very different dynamic to Australia, where First Nations Australians are by far the majority, minority.
Mm.
And so it's not surprising that you don't encounter people, but it's also part of the system is that you keep people cocooned and you socialise them. And people, again, it's a kind of geographic apartheid where First Nations people live in so-called remote communities, like over there, not here with us. And so even our language of, we talk about remote communities, people who live in those communities, that's here.
Mm.
It's not remote, it's their place.
It's their place.
And so there's this constant kind of othering of over there, those people, remote places, the outback.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not here, where's the centre of the universe.
And we all do it.
Yeah.
Back and beyond, yeah. In the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
We all do it.
Yeah. And so in a lot of ways it's not surprising
mm-hmm.
that Australians don't encounter people. And so there is that fear of the unknown, of I've never spoken to an Aboriginal person, or, you know, what do I say? Mm. And we objectify them. We then objectify their culture and their art and their dance, and we, you know, find it strange to have a welcome to country or even acknowledging country. Mm. It's like, for some people, that's like, ooh, what is this? And it's not...
They find it offensive, some people.
Yeah.
Mm.
Whereas in South Africa, albeit that we were socialised in very specific ways and sort of enculturated in particular ways, I think our actual points of connection and contact with black South Africans was in a particular way. Largely they were the servants and the cleaners of the homes and the gardeners and the cooks. They weren't our mates in the classroom.
Mm.
They weren't our buddies on the soccer field. You know, it was, we didn't have that day-to-day integrated way of relating to people. There was a, you know, master-slave relationship on the whole. And so it was quite an awakening to challenge all of that mindset and kind of work alongside activists from all around the country.
That would have shaped you, to who you are.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I think those things shape, you know, how we brought up and how we socialised and the culture that we live in definitely shapes us. And I think... No, you can look at it from the psychological perspective of kind of growing up, for a lot of people, growing up as white South Africans, a lot of it was kind of resisting their family, was part of what they got, what got them into the resistance movement, you know. So at a psychological level, you individuate from your family, you move away, you try and create your own identity. I think for a lot of people that happened through their sort of political activism as well. That's separating out and creating their own identity.
I'd like this to be a sort of a series, if you're happy with that.
Yeah. I mean, I can talk a bit about the Truth Commission and Neil Agut, who done it recently.
Mm.
Not done recently. Certainly. And I'm very mindful of the echoes and the resonances of genocide in both countries, but also of the murder of activists and of First Nations people. And it really brings to mind the death in detention, or the murder in detention, of Neil Agut, who was a medical doctor and a trade unionist in the late 70s and early 80s. He worked with the Food and Canning Workers Union, who was detained by the security police in South Africa and tortured, held for 70 days in detention, and after being repeatedly tortured was found hanging in his cell in what was called John Forster Square, which is the kind of centre of the security branch police in Johannesburg. And there was an inquest into his death, and it was found sort of was called a suicide and found to be inconclusive. So we've had The first democratic elections in 1994, we had the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, in which apartheid forces could apply for amnesty. No one associated with Neil Agut's death came forward to apply for amnesty. Then, you know, Mandela era and post-Mandela, we've had the national prosecutions, National Prosecutions Agency, and only, 37 years later since Neil died, as the family finally got permission from the National Prosecuting Association to reopen the inquest into Neil's death. And really, it begs the question of kind of what was being covered up by the apartheid regime and by the post-apartheid regime. Why would they not investigate what happened? And not literally, I think the day after the inquest into Neil's death was reopened, one of the key special branch police who'd been involved, who was known to have been involved in Agut's death, he died. But the implication is something happened in terms of the timing of, okay, we'll open the inquest, but Whitefield was the cop who suddenly died at the same time. You know, there are a number of stories of deaths in detention, or, you know, named as suicides, or people slipping on a bar of soap in the shower, and those are the stories, and some of that came out in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, but there are lots of unexplained stories. And again, it kind of echoes with the deaths that are happening here and the high number of First Nations people who are incarcerated. Ms. Du and her death in police custody. And the role and actions of police. And it's not unique to Australia or to South Africa. It's a kind of global issue. And it's part of, I don't like to use the label, but it's part of that kind of neoliberal agenda of holding on to privilege and class entitlements. And
there's not really a word for it, is there?
No.
But imperialism or something like that, that it, because it's,
it's the continuities of colonialism, yeah, but again, it's kind of words, and yeah, but it is about protecting class interests, ultimately.
I just have one more question, if that's okay, and that's, were you aware that there were anti-apartheid movements over the world?
Yes, over time, but I think when you're in it, you know, in the day-to-day activities, you know, you sort of heard about Peter Hain, and, you know, that we were aware there was a sports boycott and a cultural boycott, and musicians wouldn't come to South Africa, and we kind of supported that. It was only really in retrospect that you realise the level of international attention. There was certainly a sense of international support through international funders who funded various activities and movements. In retrospect, you can see the importance of those, that solidarity and international support. I think you, when you're in the thick of it, you don't necessarily, you're not necessarily conscious of that. You know, and this was pre-social media days, so there wasn't that kind of access to information to know that all these things were happening. It's kind of only afterwards that you piece it all together and go, okay, there's the anti-apartheid movement in Australia, and there's the anti-apartheid movement, you know, globally, but, you know, a lot of funding coming from Sweden and Denmark and Holland for activities.
Thank you. That was fascinating.
Thank you.